Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And good day, everybody, and we're glad to have you on board for another edition of Midrats. And if you are with us live, I would like to extend an invitation to you to scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you will find the chat room, and that is the perfect place if during the course of the show you have some observations you want to share or some questions that you would like for us to direct to our guests. That's the perfect place to be there. We already have Stephen and Paul there standing athwart the quarterdeck ready to greet you. And anyway, feel free to jump in with the conversation. And as always, if you got to run off and take care of some business, if you haven't done already, go over to iTunes or Spotify, wherever you get your podcast, look up Midrats and go ahead and subscribe. That way we will be ready for you at a time that's more convenient to your schedule. And on today's show, what we're going to look at is the aircraft carrier, everybody's favorite thing to argue about. We've talked about it a lot here on Midrats because it is really the supercarrier, at least, it's a unique capability that our Navy has enjoyed unquestioned dominance at for my lifetime. And I'm not a spring chicken, and even longer than that. It's been almost a century. But it's not so much like all weapon systems, and this is kind of one of the core of what we're talking about. It's not so much the ship. It's what are you trying to do as a Navy? What, as the fancy kids like to say, what effects are you trying to do? How are you trying to push forward national policy at sea? The carrier, like all weapon systems, it's a tool. So what we're going to look at today, we're going to look at the aircraft carrier and the fleet structure that is built around it, the challenges, the opportunities, the compromise. And our guest today is going to be Jeff Vandenagel, Commander, United States Navy. And as a reference point today, we're going to be looking at his book titled Questioning the Carrier, Opportunities and Fleet Design for the U.S. Navy. You can find a link on the show page. And Jeff is joining us today as an author to discuss the issues related to his book. And he does not necessarily represent the U.S. Navy or any other organizations he may be associated with. Jeff, welcome to Midrats.
Thanks a lot for having me, gentlemen. Glad to be here.
Well, we appreciate you taking some time out of your day, and it's great having authors on because it always has a real easy opening question for me. And I just want to point out to the listeners, if they haven't had a chance to look at your book yet, it's a very digestible 228 pages, but this is, and you know, bravo Zulu to you for doing this. For people that are reading this, especially those that either are new to the game or trying to get up to speed, it has 68 pages of notes and indexes. So if people really get interested or does the I didn't think about it that way and they see that footnote, you're giving them the opportunity to really expand their knowledge base. And with that kind of ball teed up for you, tell us about your book. What's it about?
Great. You make an interesting point about the index and the notes, right? So nothing in there is from my personal experience or my expertise, right? It's from a lot of smart people from throughout naval history up till today that have written on this subject. And I tried to learn from them and incorporate their thoughts in this book. In simplest term, the book argues that the age of the large nuclear-powered aircraft carrier is coming to an end, not because of its vulnerabilities, but because there are now better ways to design the fleet to accomplish the Navy's missions. Now, make no mistake, like you talked about, the large nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, it is the most powerful warship in all naval history. No single ship can match its presence value in peacetime, and no single ship can match its flexibility and its firepower in wartime. However, I believe we need the most powerful fleet possible, not the most powerful ship possible. And I believe a fleet so centralized and so dependent on 11 ships is not as capable as one that embraces some modern opportunities in fleet design. The carrier's flaws, right, They are growing, but they are not new, right? Carriers have always been expensive. They have always been somewhat vulnerable. They have always featured an air wing with a range much shorter than that of land-based aircraft, and they have always centralized a great deal of power onto a single ship. And for more than 70 years, the U.S. Navy accepted those flaws because the ship's many benefits outweighed those flaws, and there was there's no better alternative. That is no longer true. Today, the advent of missiles means that every ship in the fleet can use the era's premier weapon instead of them being limited only to large capital ships, as was true for most of naval history. Modern networks enable fleets to accurately share more information faster and over longer distances than at any point in naval history. And I think taken together, that means fleets can now diversify their kill chains to unprecedented degrees. Think advances in scouting and communications and weapons technology enable those opportunities, and they allow for a force structure that performs the carrier-centric fleet's functions more effectively, using a Navy consisting of more platforms, with less total risk, and within the same long-term budget. Now, obviously, right, like I said before, I do not identify these opportunities. The Navy has known about them for decades, and the Navy has made great progress capitalizing on them. Much of the Navy's work in these areas have already improved our fleet. However, I do not believe we can fully capitalize on those opportunities while remaining within the confines of the same rough force structure that we have had for decades, with most platforms and most operations focused on the CVN, the large nuclear-powered aircraft carrier. We will have improvements, but those improvements will be incremental, not fundamental. And I believe we'll need to achieve every possible improvement to be ready for the sea control mission against the People's Liberation Army Navy.
Well, let's talk a little bit about you describe a force which would change the structure of the Navy as we see it today. And part of that was that many more, you've listed a whole bunch of ships like the steel class corvettes and the Constellation class frigates and some changes, I gather, to the DDGs we currently have. Talk a little bit about that. I know it's not a structure that necessarily is the one you perceive being one down the road, but it's an interesting concept. Talk a little bit about how these things would mesh in the way you view it.
Sure. I think a lot of my work centered on this quote from Admiral Nimitz. And when he was talking about aircraft carrier obsolescence at the end of the Second World War, and people were trying to argue, hey, there's nuclear weapons now, so surface ships, including carriers, are obsolete. And Nimitz said, what determines the obsolescence of a weapon is not the fact that it can be destroyed, but that it can be replaced by another weapon that performs its functions more effectively. And so that is that's what I'm getting at with this hypothetical fleet. The name is the Flex Fleet, right? That is the point of the Flex Fleet is not to be this perfect structure that we're gonna go up and start building. It is purely to try and meet Nimitz's standard to show that we have a great fleet. The carrier-centric fleet is extremely powerful, but we can do even better than that if we're able to move past the confines of the carrier-centric fleet. And so I identified some opportunities that I think are out there for us, embracing the age of the missile and networking our fleet, and from those two, diversifying our kill chains. And so those are sort of the abstract opportunities. And from there, I try to translate it into a hypothetical fleet, a realistic force structure that we could actually go off and build that is technically realistic, financially realistic, operationally realistic. So in that fleet, I based on the ground rules, like I said, technologically realistic, right, is not lots of technologies that are, you know, decades away. It minimizes the number of new classes of ship, and it does that to make it politically realistic, and it uses the same long-term shipbuilding budget. And I started with the Navy's battle force inventory goals for 2049, the last year of the 2020 30-year shipbuilding plan, and I made changes to shift it to more of a structure like the new Navy fighting machine, which is a force structure proposed by Captain Wayne Hughes at the Naval Postgraduate School. So, and to get down to the details, right, it adds missile corvettes and missile arsenal ships to improve our ability to do sea control and contested power projection. It starts shifting naval aviation to light carriers to improve their geographic spread and platform numbers. It builds more Constellation-class frigates than the Navy's current plan to increase the number of platforms and missiles we'd have in the fleet. And it increases the size of the combat logistics force to supply that enlarged fleet. And then it pays for that by canceling the remainder of the Ford class, reducing the number of planned new construction Arleigh Burke follow-on DDGs, the DDG-X, and then cancels plans for the conventionally armed Columbia-class SSGN, as a surface fleet in the flex fleet construct would have significantly increased numbers of missile cells. And then so in one of the subsequent chapters, I try and compare the Navy's planned fleet of 2049 in this hypothetical flex fleet and in the Navy's various mission areas. And I think in a lot of mission areas, this hypothetical fleet could outperform the Navy's 2049 fleet, right? It has something like 42% more warships, 86% more missile-launching surface ships, 2,900 additional missile cells. But again, flex fleet, far from a great solution, has lots of problems, lots of unanswered questions. I just think it gets to Nimitz's standard of can we do even better than our current carrier-centric force? And if so, then there's a lot of much smarter people out there with a lot of great ideas. For example, Captain Klein at the Naval Postgraduate School and his colleagues, or Dmitry Filipov and his colleagues at SIMSAC, or lots of people within the Navy or the Center for Naval Analyses, right, all have lots of great ideas, which I don't think we can fully capitalize while staying within the confines of the carrier-centric model.
I think a great thing about your book is, as you would expect from a nuclear-trained submarine officer, you've done the math, is if people want to grab hold of, like, your flex fleet design, you go, okay, I've done the math. Here's the numbers. If you want to argue that, you know, 10% this way or that way, we can do that. But I thought what was also good, because a little habit of mine, we've all, no reason to name names here, but we've all read some people's theories of what the future fleet will be, and your eyes roll the back of your head because they just, you know, wave away technology risk, program risk, and stuff like that. And I like the 2049 data point, because 2049 may seem like a long time in the future for folks, but it's really not. 2049 is to today what 1991 is to today. It's the same time difference. And when you look at plus or minus a couple years from that 1999, that is where the thought processes came forward, what we saw in the first decade of the century, the often discussed age of transformation that begat LCS, CGX, DDG 1000, et cetera, and so forth, that, you know, kind of waved away a lot of the technology and the program risk. But what you've done is, I've liked how you've put firm boundaries on here, is technologically realistic, financially feasible, and only incorporates a reasonable number of new types of ships. A lot of the ships you're describing here, they're not revolutionary, they're not transformational, they don't require unobtainium or pixie dust. It's all either existing systems or, you know, mod 2 or mod 3 of programs that we have coming across the transom here. Talk for a little bit about how you when you were trying to intellectualize 2049, what are those hard barriers you see, what are those soft known unknowns you think could shape things one way or another inside the next few years?
Great, thanks. Yeah, I mean, you hit on the head. There's lots of technologies already out there that I mean, again, the Navy's taking advantage of, and we have available now because of the Navy's hard work. But for this, I think of Eugene Ely, right? So something like 1910, he gets in his biplane, and he takes off from the cruiser Birmingham, right? And so it's this, like, rickety wooden ramp in this rickety biplane, but he takes off, and it's the first time that an aircraft has ever launched from a warship in naval history, right? Incredible accomplishment. Did the Navy immediately restructure its force, you know, its the fleet around the aircraft carrier? No. And was that because of, you know, obstructionism or anything like that? No. It was because it takes a very long time to develop the technologies that are necessary to change the United States Navy, this huge organization with thousands of people and ships and everything like that. And so just because Eli was able to launch an aircraft from a warship doesn't mean that the Navy was ready to transform its fleet structure. It took a long time of experimenting and testing and working and all sorts of stuff to get the Navy ready. And then when a mission came along that required naval aviation and the aircraft carrier, the Navy was for the most part ready because of the work of people like Eli and Admiral William Moffett and other pioneers like that. And so I think we're at a similar sort of era today in that, right, there's lots of these technologies that I talk about in the book. They've been around for decades, before I was born, right? Missiles and network communications and things along those lines. And lots of people have written about them, and the Navy has done lots and lots of work on them. We haven't restructured the fleet to fully take advantage of those opportunities, not because of obstructionism or people are stuck in the past or anything like that. It's just because it takes a very long time to develop those technologies to make them robust enough to change the fleet structure, which, again, is a massive thing. And like you talked about, yeah, 2049, that's a long ways away, but in shipbuilding world, that's tomorrow. And it takes a long time to build a ship and to change a fleet structure. And I just think with some of these technologies that we have, and because of the hard work of the Navy, that we're in a position now, because of all that work, to start moving away from the carrier-centric fleet.
Yeah, I think that the concern you have, and I think you make a really good. If you were an associate in a law firm, and I'm a lawyer, so I can say these kind of things. If you're an associate in a law firm, I would really be impressed with the brief you've laid out here. I mean, this is a really good argument you've made, and it's very logical. It makes a lot of sense, and you base it on the sound concept that the potential enemies we face want to get deeply into area denial, and they've been able to push the carrier back, and then due to other changes we've made, we've limited the range of the aircraft that are on the carriers. So the further back we get pushed, the arsenal that makes a carrier work can't really play in the game anymore. So talk a little bit about the arguments that you make that why this flex fleet with more ships, more dispersal, networking works better than the I think it's 4% of the Navy that occupies 47% of our naval personnel at sea that we have now.
Great, will do. So I think, like I said at the beginning, right, the CVN is the most powerful ship in the fleet if it can operate as designed. And for many, many years, because we control the seas, it could operate as designed. And so it went off and did great things for the Navy, and it did great things for the nation. And from Libya, Korea, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq, all over the place, aircraft carriers done great things. And that's because it excels at presence missions, right, and permissive power projection. On the presence factor, right, there is no ship that can make headlines like an aircraft carrier does. And for permissive power projection, right, no fleet structure, including this hypothetical one that I talk about, no structure is going to match the carrier's ability to generate sorties from uncontested seas. However, and so if we think those are the missions that we're going to focus on going forward, presence missions and permissive power projection, that would be a very reasonable conclusion. It's what we've done for a long time. It's what we've done well for a long time. However, I think if we need to focus on sea control and contested power projection against a peer adversary, such as the People's Liberation Army Navy, then I think different structures can do that even better. And so, and part of it is because we live in the age of the missile. So much, I just think, so throughout naval history, there's a close relation between physics and the era's capital ship. Let me back up. There's been a close relationship between the era's capital ship and the weapon that it carried, just based on physics. So only huge multi-deck ships of the line like HMS Victory could physically carry dozens of cannon, and only huge battleships like USS Missouri could physically carry 16-inch guns, and only huge aircraft carriers like USS Ford can physically launch dozens of F-35s. And so as a result of that relationship, most of the fleet could not use the era's premier weapon. Smaller ships still did lots of important things, but they generally could not carry 16-inch guns or dozens of F-35s or anything like that. However, I think the missile changes that relationship. It means every single ship in the fleet, plus aircraft and unmanned vessels or submarines or support vessels or amphibious ships or even trucks, can carry the era's premier weapon. And that is an incredible opportunity today for fleets. And that is, I think, more than anything, what gives this flex fleet contractor the edge over the carrier-centric fleet, is that instead of most fleet operations having to flow through the CVN, and with a lot of the fleet supporting the CVN, now almost every single platform in the fleet can use the era's premier weapon and can deliver its own attacks. Now, obviously, larger ships are still more capable than smaller ships, but no longer is it suicidal for a small ship to fight against a large ship because we live in the age of the missile. And those missiles they're inexpensive, they're technically simple to operate, they don't require local air or maritime superiority, they be launched in large numbers without tactical, human, financial risk of a manned aircraft. They have a huge payoff if successful, little downside if they fail, and they're exceedingly difficult to defend against, because the attacker has advantage in physics, numbers, and time. And so if you add that with our ability to network the fleet and thus diversify our kill chains, I think that gives us a great opportunity, right? We can design a fleet built around both small and large platforms that all have the ability to close the kill chain independently or cooperatively. That fleet has more platforms launching more weapons from more vectors, more domains. And that all makes it hard for the enemy to defend against attacks and raises the chances that we'll complete at least one kill chain to destroy the target.
I like how you emphasize a fair bit something that can get lost in a lot of these conversations because there's so many factors involved here. But it's the question that you ask early on in your book. It's, quote, what is the most effective way to damage the enemy, unquote. And you just mentioned in your answer to Mark's question about the age of the missile. And it's interesting how here we are in 2024 trying to get people to focus on that ultimate question, what is both outgoing and incoming the most effective weapon to use? Because if you want to say when was the age of the missile's coming out party, yes, when I was in diapers back in 1967 at the hands of the Egyptians, which is a much longer timeline than the timeline from throwing a string bag off the end of a cruiser to the Battle of Midway. So this isn't something that has happened overnight, but it's been that slow evolution of both defense and offense. And one of the things you've also done the math on that really kind of got my attention and got me focused on that, it has to do with the fact that, some things that haven't changed is the size of the Earth, the nature of the surface of the Earth, but what has changed is our technology. And when you look at surveillance, reconnaissance, intelligence, the change in the ability for even second-tier or third-tier adversaries to have a better awareness of what's on the planet, that kind of has worked in conjunction with the hard math that missiles represent.
Absolutely. I think historically, the carrier's best defense and one of its greatest attributes has been its ability to remain unlocated. And, it's mobile, it can move, so it's difficult for the enemy to track it. I think its ability to stay hidden, just like any other large surface ship today, is more difficult than at any point throughout naval history. Right? Just trends in scouting and communications makes it exceptionally difficult to keep a large platform, as large and as recognizable as a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, makes it very, very difficult to keep that hidden for any appreciable amount of time. And so, obviously, that affects all surface ships, not just CVNs, but it's especially problematic for the CVN because it's so recognizable and its signature is so huge. And then also, its loss would be catastrophic, right? Lots of ships we can lose and would be painful, but would not fundamentally alter the the power or the structure of the United States Navy. But losing a ship of $12 billion that recommends or that represents the might of the American Navy and of the country, that would have unmatched financial and diplomatic and operational impacts. And all that comes down to, you know, like you're talking about scouting and how difficult it is to remain hidden on the surface of the sea today. I mean, if the Japanese could find carriers using 1940s technology, and if the Argentinians could find the surface fleet using 1980s technology, then surely our adversaries can likely do it today using all those same tools plus satellite networks and advanced sensors and communications and cyber attacks and things along those lines. It just makes it very, very difficult to keep something like that hidden for so long. And like we know from Captain Hughes, if it can be found, that can lead to attacking effectively first, and that's the key to tactics at sea.
Yeah, I was going to say the spirit of Wayne Hughes is alive and well in your book. You were kind of talking, as part of the book, you talk about some of the obstacles to something like the Flex fleet being developed, because for years, guys like Hughes and Sobrowski and other people have said, we don't need the huge carrier, we need to diversify, we need to think differently. And the resistance sometimes of the large corporations, I think your example that Huntington Industries, whoever, the big shipyard in Norfolk that makes the nuclear carriers. But there was a great quote that you had about from Barney Rubble that it doesn't seem reasonable to presume that the strategic future of the United States hinges on a few thousand shipyard workers in Virginia. I mean, the way the book is structured, we would have to produce a lot of the corvettes and more frigates and then these missile vessels, which I think we ought to talk about down here a little bit too, the brass missile boats. I mean, I like the concept. I mean, I'm a big fan of missile barges, if nothing else. But to talk a little bit about how the money would be shifted away from some of the larger entities, and this is to appease the shipyard workers, so these guys would still have work. It would just be a different kind of work.
Definitely. Yeah, so I think... I think this change would need to come from within the Navy, but that to accomplish it, we would have to earn the buy-in from lots of key organizations, including industry, right? And so, I mean, that's part of the reason why I think the Marine Corps' Force Design 2030 has been successful, because it wasn't just the Marines, right? They went out and they earned buy-in from all the numerous constituencies that had some sort of part to play. And to shift past the carrier-centric fleet, right? That would be infinitely more difficult than Force Design 2030, which is already, you know, an impressive thing that they pulled off. And so, if we're going to do this, like I said, I think the Navy would need to lead that shift, just because of how complex and how difficult and how long this will take, and the million factors that will go into such a shift. But then the Navy will certainly need to earn buy-in from constituencies such as HII, right? Because, you know, like you said, right, it's not like we can afford as a nation to just say, well, you know, we're not going to use HII anymore and we're just going to move on or anything like that, right? They are clearly, we need shipyards building ships. I'm just saying that we should shift what types of ships we build. And so obviously there's a future for HII building, aircraft carriers or submarines or whatever else we choose to build. But I just think shifting away from the CVN and aligning incentives for all the constituencies, that's going to be an important part for the Navy to earn that sort of buy-in as we go forward. I would also say for Captain Hughes and Admiral Sobrowski and those, you know, obviously distinguished gentlemen that made these cases well before I did, and much better than I ever could. I think part of the challenge that they faced was that they were writing, you know, 30 years ago when we did not have a credible adversary at sea. I think Captain Hendricks has talked about this, how fleet design is a function of both technology and the mission of the fleet. And so, you know, we probably had the technology to evolve the fleet 30 years ago when people like Captain Hughes and Admiral Sobrowski and such were making these arguments. However, I don't think we had the mission at the time, right? And so there's the Cold War had just ended, and the Chinese Navy was a obsolete coastal force, and so we control the seas. And so we appropriately focused our attention to power projection from uncontested seas. But now, because of the hard work of the Navy developing those technologies, and because we now have the People's Liberation Army Navy to face off against, I think we have both the technology and the mission to start evolving the fleet.
Well, let's look a little bit at the People's Republic of China's Navy, because you're exactly right. You know, when we go back again to 1999, and the world, especially contested at sea, in the we're still in the light post Cold War era. Things are very different here in 2024. So when you look at the People's Republic of China and her Navy, what do you see about their fleet design, what they've invested in?
Yeah, so I think they, I think there's a lot of, you know, DOD reporting and everything along those lines of that they are focused on, you know, war at sea and sinking an opposing fleet. I mean, Captain Fennell had that, I mean, he had that quote at USNI West about 10 years ago, and at the time it was sort of shocking that he said it, but now I think widely accepted that that is the People's Liberation Army Navy, right? They're clearly focused on winning control of the Western Pacific. And again, you can read any sort of like the annual DOD report to Congress on the Chinese fleet and read about their prolific use of missiles and how, I mean, essentially every single platform, aircraft, et cetera, in their fleet has very capable anti-ship cruise missiles. I think of the Falklands War, right? And so in that war, the Argentinians had just 7 Exocets, anti-ship cruise missiles. And with those 7 missiles, they sank 2 Royal Navy ships, and they caused significant damage to a third. So today, a single Chinese Hubei missile craft has more anti-ship cruise missiles than the Argentinians had or used in the entire war. And right, the Chinese Navy has reportedly thousands of them. So it's just just more evidence that we live in the age of the missile and that we need to do everything possible to capitalize on that, because obviously our adversaries are doing the same.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. When you got into the discussion of the subsurface, I mean, the threats to the carrier, and certainly the subsurface threats, submarines and mines are key to those. But at one point you discussed the effect of having so many anti-ship cruise missiles on the submarines, where you could put 10 submarines out of the range of our detection, but you know, all they need is a targeting cue, and they can launch a lot of anti-ship cruise missiles at a carrier and go from there. Talk a little bit about that kind of threat and what that means in terms of what we have to do to try and protect the carriers, which I think is, as your book points out pretty well, it's not quite a hopeless task, but it's pretty darn close to it.
Sure. I would recommend your listeners go to the China Maritime Studies Institute at the Naval War College, right? They've done lots of great work studying the Chinese submarine fleet. And I mean, one of the things they've talked about is exactly what you're getting out of, the use of how Chinese submarines are in many ways anti-surface platforms, and that instead of, you know, trying to drive around and develop their tactics and get close for torpedo shots and everything like that, they're essentially like a floating mine with a anti-ship cruise missile, so that they can stay off in wherever they, you know, whatever area they can find, and then when they get queuing from somewhere else, launch their missiles. I think I really try to learn the lessons of naval history, right? Because any sort of fleet designer is going to, you know, we use all available tools, war games and exercises and intel analyses and things along those lines. And they're all valuable tools. But I don't think anything matches the value of naval combat and learning from that. However, there's very little naval combat above the seas to learn from, and there's significantly less beneath the seas. There's the only three times that a submarine has engaged in combat other than launching Tomahawks since World War II is the Indo-Pakistan War of 1971, the Falklands War of 1982, and the North Korean sinking of a South Korean corvette in 2010. And so, it makes it very difficult to learn the lessons of naval history to understand the impact that submarines will have today on the aircraft carrier or any sort of surface ship. But I would, again, go back to the Falklands War right there. A single nuclear-powered submarine, the HMS Conqueror, launched a single salvo and sank a single ship, the ARA General Belgrano. And the Argentinians withdrew their entire fleet to port out of fear of additional attack. So the one time that we've seen a nuclear power submarine go into combat, it defeated an entire navy. And so today, our adversaries have a lot more submarines than what the Argentinians had, which is just, one or two at sea throughout their war, which even that one or two, the Royal Navy could not find throughout the entire war and launch something like 200 torpedoes at it. So fast forward to today, right, our adversaries have much larger undersea fleets, and so it just, I think it would make it very, very difficult to generate the perfect defense that we need for a priceless ship, the aircraft carrier. I think the aircraft carrier's defense above the seas and beneath the seas is very, very good, right? It is the best defended surface ship in the world. But I don't think that defense is still good enough for a ship that we cannot lose, that we must protect because of how important and how valuable it is. And in the era of capable submarines, I just think that would be a very difficult task. Now, to be clear, I am a submariner, so I am not arguing that surface ships are suddenly obsolete or anything like that. I think there's many of the Navy's missions that submarines can't do or can't do as effectively as surface ships. But I just think centralizing so much of the fleet's firepower on 11 ships is inadvisable when we have to face modern undersea threats.
I do like how you it almost preempts anybody saying a comment, was he just making these stuff out of your head? It's like, no, here's references A through F from history, which found, because you only have, and you're right, there are limited points of reference for modern naval warfare, but there are clear trends that you can see. And I like what you brought up about the Royal Navy and the Falkland Islands. I know most of it is still on the high side, but for those that still have access to CIPRNet, if you have the ability to see the classified briefing on the ASW weapon usage of the Royal Navy, it'll sober you up real fast about what people will drop on what they think is a submarine. It's I think that goes with Mark's comment about this is a great scary story if you read it a certain way. But I wanted to, speaking of history, learning lessons, you can't see the future, obviously, but congrats on page 14, name-dropping the Houthis, because since the book's come out, we've obviously had a few months of very real-world experience about what our ships can do and perhaps what our allies can't do against anti-ship cruise missile, even probably... Again, I'm just guessing here, Generation Zero or Generation One anti-ship ballistic missiles, and even a new twist of the subsonic flying lawnmower variety of anti-ship drones that we've seen off of Houthi-controlled Yemen. What are some of your quick look lessons that you've seen so far, and how does that bounce off of some of the research you did for your book?
Yeah, great point. Like I said, right, I think there's numerous resources we can use to prepare for future combat, but that naval history is the most important of them. And so that's what makes the actions in the Red Sea so interesting and so important to learn from. I don't think that there are any wildly new lessons here, but reinforcements of lessons we've already learned throughout naval history. And none of this is to comment or judgment on what we've done so far or an opinion on what I think we should be doing or anything like that, right? That's not my place. It's not my purpose here. It's just my attempts to understand the lessons of naval history, and obviously this is very recent naval history. So First, I think this whole series of events shows the value of the Navy, right? Throughout its history, it's been very difficult for the Navy to convey to the public the vital functions it performs in peacetime, functions that the other services largely cannot do. I mean, the Navy enables trade, shows the flag, reassures allies, deters adversaries, all from powerful and flexible platforms that right, they arrive quickly on station with minimal support if they're not there already. And whether that was Ford and Hirschreich Group quickly arriving off Israel after Hamas's attack or the fleet's defensive shipping against Houthi attacks, I mean, I think the Navy has excelled in its peacetime role in a way that is more visible and more understandable to the American public than normal day-to-day operations, right? It's difficult to explain to the average citizen why they should care about the writings of Alfred Thayer Mahan, but it's easy for that average citizen to understand that the Houthis are attacking the ships delivering his Amazon products, and that those deliveries are now going to be slower and more expensive, but that the U.S. Navy is at sea protecting those citizens' deliveries. I think with the Secretary of Defense needed a powerful deterrent force on short notice, he did not turn to the Army or Air Force, right? Very capable, impressive forces, but they have huge logistics trains and would take weeks or months to arrive, right? He ordered the fleet to the Eastern Mediterranean. Instead of weeks of planning and packing and talking and moving and shipping, it just took a few young helmsmen to shift a few rudders and reposition the fleet to where the President needed. I think second... I think the last few months showed yet again the value of the aircraft carrier, right? Like I said before, there's no ship that can match its deterrent value or ability to protect power from uncontested seas, the exact two missions that are called for in the region right now. With its powerful air wing, unmatched endurance and logistics, it was immediately ready to deter additional attacks on Israel and launch strikes on our adversaries. And I think third, the Houthis' attack on shipping and our fleet reinforced that we live in the age of the missile, and that tactically, offense dominates at sea, right? I think we agree the Houthis, rebels living in the desert, are not the most technologically advanced or capable adversary our Navy has ever faced. But despite those advantages, right, they have had a huge impact on global trade and U.S. Navy operations, and a huge reason for that is because they have been able to use missiles, which, again, cheap, easy to operate, don't require much infrastructure to use, don't require air or maritime superiority, and have little downside if they fail. And then on the other side, defending against those missiles requires constant vigilance 24/7, requires advanced sensors, very capable interceptors. And then whereas the attacker only needs one missile to get through, the defender has to intercept or avoid every single incoming shot, meaning the attacker always has the advantage at sea. So I think all those sorts of factors inform the conclusions of my book, right? The carrier's defense is very, very good. It is the best defended surface ship in the world. However, in the age of the missile, with the advantage always on the attacker's side, and with modern trends in scouting and weapons technology, and with a very capable adversary now, I do not think that we should plan for a perfect defense for such a priceless ship. And I think my final takeaway from the action of the Red Sea is that it... again, demonstrates the carrier's utility for permissive power projection, but it offers little evidence of its sea control or contested power projection capabilities, right? We already know that the carrier excels at benign area strike. See Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, etc. Right? That just reinforces what we already know. I think, however, some people have tried to make the argument that this shows the carrier is still the premier fighting unit at sea, but the Houthis do not have a Navy, and they do not have an Air Force. And I don't think we should confuse the carrier's great success against that irregular force as evidence of the platform's sea control or contested power projection capabilities against the PLAN or another adversary.
Yeah, I think the actually, in terms of your book, it's the DDGs and the French... and Italian and the Brits and their constellation type frigates sort of ships that are doing a lot of the load of shooting down these things as the Houthis are tossing out as they're on the way. The carrier has been used to try to it reminds me of the Scud hunts during Desert Storm. That they shoot, they move, and then you're either blasting empty sand or you're if the people are smart, they're shooting these things from mosques and other places where if they get hit, they can go complain about things. But I think the lesson is well made. I mean, a shore-based group with modern technology, which is in this case fairly simple missiles, or as Sal says, the Rice Krispie box drones. They can do a lot of damage, and they can do it fairly far out at sea. We've seen in the Black Sea the Ukrainians using these remote semi-submersible units taking out big chunks of the Russian Navy. So I think there's a lot to be concerned about if you're worried about a giant aircraft carrier. And I think your book aptly points out that it's smaller, dare we say it, more expendable ships that may be the wave of the future to help fight this kind of thing.
Yep, I think every one of those ships is less survivable than a CVN, right? No, make no mistake. But Admiral Sobrowski had this great quote that I really liked about it is, you know, fleet survivability, not platform survivability that matters. And so I think this large distributed fleet that the Navy has already identified and I think in many ways working towards, I think that is a more survivable option than one centered on 11 ships that we must protect.
A couple of items that you talked about in about the middle of your book that, you know, if you want to watch somebody get some flop sweat real fast, especially if you're on a surface fleet, is talk about a unlocated submarine or all of a sudden you find yourself in a minefield. These are threats that have been with us for a century, but especially at the end of the Cold War, and I really look at mine warfare in this regard, but also anti-submarine warfare, is there's been a lot of assumptions about what can be done from the air and on the surface to try to counter both of these threats. So when you're looking at a proposed fleet for 2049, what are some of the critical capabilities and vulnerabilities that you see from these two old scourges of the skimmers? That's your unknown submarine and your mines.
Sure. Yeah. So I forget who I actually quote in the book, but ASW, it is a team sport, right? It requires lots of platforms searching for a submarine. And so we have chosen as a Navy to build exquisite platforms, and that's obviously an understandable decision, and those are great ships. The unintended consequence of that is we have we have fewer ships than what we would like. We do not have a huge fleet inventory because we chose those exquisite ships. And so I think to effectively do anti-submarine warfare, you need lots of platform searching. So that's what I tried to do in the Flex Fleet contract, right? So increase the number of Constellation class frigates that we're planning on building, and then adding some ASW capability to some of these corvettes, and just spreading the field as much as possible to find submerged threats before they're able to attack us. And then also that it's much of the Flex Fleet structure sort of acknowledges that we're going to take losses. And so it tries to prepare for that eventuality. And it does that by spreading out the capabilities to more ships. And so when those submarines do have an impact and they do sink a ship, it is not catastrophic and it is not fundamentally change the power of that fleet. It is still painful and it still has impact, but the fleet overall can continue to fight. I think if anything, overall, what I'm trying to get across in this book is that the fleet metrics matter, right? So there is no ship that's going to compete with a Ford class, and there's no class of ship that's going to compete with a Ford class, right? It is very, very powerful, and nothing on a one-to-one comparison is going to beat it. But I think there are fleet structures that can compete with the carrier-centric model, and they can do even better than our already impressive fleet in our various mission areas, including anti-submarine warfare, as you talk about, and mines as well, right? So no one wants to talk about mines. They're boring. I don't want to talk about mines, but they're going to have a huge they could have a huge impact because, again, they're cheap, they're easy, and then if you have a very, very powerful ship and you've lost it to just a few mines, I mean, that is a painful day.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to I think a really excellent point you made in the book about these, you call them the brass missile ships, and the effect of those is you would load up a ship with a lot of vertical launch cells, and it would expend those aiming at things picked up by DDGs and other assets, but when they emptied, they would just go back and reload. And another one would take their place. Talk a little bit about that concept and why that's a benefit to the Navy to be able to keep some of its frontline ships on the line rather than having to go back and rearm.
Yep. So the idea is, again, in trying to keep things technologically simple. And so I know the Navy's working very, very hard on figuring out how to reload VLS at sea, and I have no doubt that we will get there. But I try to go the simple route. Instead of trying to figure out how to do that at sea, I just said, let's just replace the entire VLS bank. And so if a DDG shoots all of its missiles and has to go back to port, that is painful for the fleet, right? Because DDG is very, very capable, and we lose all sorts of capabilities, right? An Arleigh Burke is much more than just its missile cells, right? Great radar and sonar and command and control and all sorts of things like that. But it's, this arsenal ship that we're talking about, and that can be a merchant ship we have some unmanned platforms that are working toward that. When that ship leaves, well, we really just lose its empty missile cells, so it's not a big impact. And so that lets more capable ships like DDG stay at sea and do great things, and then you can just cycle out these much cheaper ships that are really just ammo ships. That lets the Navy's most capable platforms do what they do best and keep all the DDG's many impressive capabilities at sea, and then but at the same time gets a lot more missiles into the fleet.
On a lot of issues, I have a little ditty I always try to I try to say to people who kind of get fidgety when you talk about change, is like, hey, I understand change is different. Different is scary. Scary is bad. So let's not do anything different. And when you look at our wonderfully complex acquisition system that we've imposed on ourselves and our two-year election cycles, those are the two things that really popped in my mind on a quote that you have. And I'm going to steal this and use it for future use, Jeff. So please don't sue me for it. But I'll quote you to yourself for the listeners who haven't gotten to page 70 yet. Quote, changing a baseball team or any fleet structure can be difficult and temporarily expensive, unquote. And that second part, the temporarily expensive, I don't think we have the muscle memory, we being the Navy side or really any military side of the equation, our senior leadership on the civilian and military side, and even the navalist influencers out in the civilian sectors, have good muscle memory on how to discuss about temporarily expensive, especially inside of a POM cycle, to get gains at year 5, 6, 7, because there's also a history of people overpromising and under-delivering about savings. What are some of the ideas that you have, besides some of the hard math that you have demonstrated in your book, that could help people to start to do that message about how change does have some initial cost, but that investment really pays off down the road? Because that's a hard sell.
Definitely. There are many problems with my book that people could point out, and they would be right. And one of them is that I don't really delve into the details of, like, short-term, what you're talking about, short-term, how to get small wins and start shift this evolution, right? I say, well, here we are, and 30 years from now, this is where we should be, and someone smarter than me, let's figure out the middle. A lot of it is maybe similar to what the Marine Corps did, right? It's not like we're just going to announce, like, hey, we're done building carriers, the end, right? A ton would have to change, and that means we would have to think about a lot of this before we started doing something like that. And Like I said earlier in the show, I think it would be more, you know, lots of organizations are needed. We have to earn their buy-in, but I think the Navy would have to lead that. And so just like the Marines did lots of thinking and experimentation and things along those lines for Force Design 2030, I think the Navy would have to do the same before it committed to shifting away from the carrier-centric fleet. And I think, you know, obviously Navy has thought about it for a long time, and you know, lots of smarter people than me are already thinking about that and coming up with ways to slowly move us in that direction. And you know, you're seeing some of these smaller. You know, we've got Constellation class, right? Which is, it's not a small ship, but it is a smaller ship than what we've had in the past. And then we've seen advances in hypersonic weapons, and we've seen advances in some of the unmanned platforms. I think all those things give the Navy's leadership options to go to if we decide that it is that we've reached the end of the age of the CVN.
Yeah, I want to. We're getting close to the end, but I wanted to kind of have you discuss the inertia that you foresee. And using the Marine Corps and General Berger's vision of where the Marine Corps was going to move, how does the Navy overcome the various, conservative groups that do not want to change? They think that this is the best of all possible worlds.
Yep. I think it starts with the Navy. It can't just be like, oh, the carriers are vulnerable and we should stop building it, right? We have to have a better answer. And like I've said, the carrier-centric fleet is very, very good. So we would have to come up with something even better if we're going to do that to earn all those people's buy-ins, all those organizations' buy-in. I'm an optimist in that I don't believe that there's some like a nefarious group that's going to, you know, stop this. Like, yes, it'll be extremely difficult, right? I mean, presidents have tried to end the carrier, and secretaries of defense, and everything, and they've not succeeded. So, yes, I got it. It'll be very, very difficult. But we've done it before, right? There's a story of obstructionist battleship admirals leading up to World War II, and that they stopped all innovation, things like that. But that is a myth. I mean, in reality, the Navy made great progress developing naval aviation because of leaders like Admirals William Moffett and William Sims and Eli that we talked about earlier in the show. And so, you know, they developed new aircraft and new ways of fighting and new training systems. And so that when a mission came along that required naval aviation, sea control against the Imperial Japanese Navy, the U.S. Navy was for the most part ready because of their pioneering work. And so, I think bottom line, right, the Navy's leadership has done before, and I have no doubt that whenever they decide that it is time to shift, that they'd be able to do it again. It would be very, very difficult, yes, but I think possible, and I think necessary.
Well, Jeff, like Mark said, you know, we're coming near the end of the hour, and you still got a legit day job wearing a uniform, so I know you're a busy guy, and this was obviously a heck of a lot of work and research. Like I started the show with extensive notes and index that can help the listener if they want to dive into a topic or two a little bit further. But if our listeners want to keep an eyeball on you on what your thoughts and what you're focused on, where's a good place for them to go? And are you working on anything else as a follow-on?
Yeah, to find me, I mean, it turns out there's not too many Jeff Van Den Engels out there, so be easy enough to find, you know, all the normal social media and such. And then as far as future projects, I was trying to work on something, but, so hopefully earn a spot back in Proceedings or SimSec or somewhere along those lines in the future. But thank you very much, gentlemen, for having me on.
Well, it's been great, and I highly recommend people read your book. It is well laid out, very logical, and if you care about national defense and Navy issues, it'll probably scare the socks off you in a few places.
Yeah, just in time for 2024 Halloween, if folks haven't gotten it, they can get ready. But thanks again, Jeff, and really appreciate you taking time to join us today. And thank you very much, everybody else, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. And until next time, we hope y'all have a great Navy day. Cheers.
alone, he wants to marry me, and so leave the strand and Piccadilly.